literally like whack-a-mole, because you shut down one, a new thing is going to come up. For example, YouTube. Children start looking at YouTube from like the time they're born. This is like having a malware in for a previous generation in TV. This is not something which is an email, you work on it, your text. This is something that you're used to. It's an extremely trusted one.
All that and more on Security Intelligence. Hello and happy Halloween, and welcome to Security Intelligence, IBM's weekly cybersecurity podcast, where we break down the most terrifying stories in the field with the help of our panel of experts. I'm your host, Matt Kaczynski, and this year I'm going as the scariest thing I can think of, a guy who still uses single-factor authentication. Joining me today, we have Suja Viswasan, IBM VP of Security Products, J.R. Rao, IBM Fellow and CTO Security Research, and Dave McGinnis, Global Partner, IBM's Cyber Threat Management Offering Group. In honor of the spooky season, we've got five frightful stories to cover, and stay tuned after the conversation for a sneak peek of a special episode coming out later this week. But today we are covering YouTube's Ghost Network, the Glassworm malware, how enterprises neglect mobile security, the great AWS outage of 2025. But first, is there such thing as a safe AI browser? Now, I'm sure everybody knows that last week, OpenAI released Atlas, a web browser with ChatGPT and agentic capabilities built right in, which sounds really cool, but experts are already warning that it, like Perplexity's Comet before it, is vulnerable to prompt injections, right? Attackers can hide malicious code in web content, images, even URLs to hijack these browsers and influence their behavior and make them do all kinds of nasty stuff. So to get us started today, I want to ask everybody real quick, kind of around the table, as a security professional, would you use one of these things? And I'll start with you, Dave. How are you feeling about these AI browsers?
Oh my goodness. No, I would not use them. Not yet. I mean, look, the promise is there. Just we're a little early. The rush to get these things to market has not allowed them to be secured. I think that's, you know, my biggest worry, right? Is you know, I want an assistant so bad that I don't bother to check their credentials. You know, and that's kind of the parallel for me. So, you know, that's what we've seen with this particular browser. That's probably what we'll see with the next one. You know, I mean, the heartening thing for me, like I've been in security for, you know, 20 plus years. Don't ask me how long. Just that suffice it to know. But like, at least we're thinking about it now. You're right. Like if we go back through the other big hills of IT, you know, advancements. And JR's been with me through a couple of these. So, you know, the at least security in AI is being thought of shortly thereafter. Like we've had a big advancement in AI and people go, wait a minute, I don't know if I can trust this just yet. This is good, right? It comes out and we all immediately are thinking like, wait a second, hold on. Like, can we prompt inject this? Can I trust this? Wait. What if it starts acting unethically on my behalf? And it's, right? Like these, this, so no, I think, you know, for me, Matt, this is a little bit early.
Absolutely. And I like the idea of, you know, it's like an agent, it's an assistant that you want so badly that you're not checking the credentials, right? Because I can see that, especially for a lot of everyday users who might not know much about how this stuff works. They just see shiny new browser, they download it, they're excited, they're not taking precautions. JR, how about you? Would you use one of these things?
I tend to agree here with Dave. I think, I might use it for some casual browsing, you know, maybe summarizing a few articles or question answering, where the risk is extremely low. But these browsers are not ready for enterprise use. They're not ready for high stakes, especially when you have sensitive data, right? And so, and absolutely, if you have any workflows that include things like confidential research, financial information, or even, you know, anything that requires your credentials, I think the level of maturity for these offerings is very low at this point in time, and they're very immature, I would say. And I think we have to wait until we start fitting security into these browsers and we get some guarantees before we can go forward to start using them for any mission critical use.
Absolutely. And Suja, how about you? What are you feeling about these browsers?
I'm still going to be curious. And I would, because I want to know what is it, right? Aren't you curious? I'd be curious. So I would actually use it in a machine where I don't have any of my bank accounts ever stored in it. Okay. That's the most important thing than anything else. And no financial data in that laptop or phone, whichever I'm using, that's what I would use. I would have a dumb phone to use it.
That makes a lot of sense. And that brings me to my next kind of question for you folks, right, is we all kind of agree, it seems like, that these things are just, they're not ready for prime time yet. They're interesting, they could do some cool stuff, but they're not ready for prime time. What's it going to take to get them there? And I'll go back around the circle in reverse order this time. Suja, what do you think we need to get these things to a place where they might be good for enterprise use? Do you think we can get there?
I think they need to be starting about the security aspect of it, shifting left and thinking about it first, right? That is what is going to get them. Because governance, the regulations are also always going to catch up. We saw it with data, right? GDPR and everything else. After we gave our data for free is when those regulations came in. Governance and regulations are going to be later, no matter how early they think they are. So the biggest thing, if somebody wants to make money, a business that wants to start enterprise using it, they need to be shifting left, thinking about security, and have those testing done. Because, look, the rules are there for the good people. The bad guys don't have any rules.
That's a really good point. We set up those rules, right? And the bad guys, they're not going to listen anyway, right? JR, how about you? What are you feeling like? I feel like Suja kind of agreed with you there. You were saying you want to see security earlier in the process. Do you have anything to add there? What do you think it's going to take?
I think even OpenAI with Atlas and even some of the others like Perplexity with Comet and so on, they've been very clear that while they've done security engineering, right, that there are many areas where things like prompt injection, which remains a frontier, which remains an unsolved security problem for them, and they need to be able to address some of these before they move forward. So fundamentally, if you look at where the problems are, I think you need to do things like detection of prompt injection, prompt sanitization, if you will. You need to be able to isolate content and context, specifically because many times what the attackers are doing is they are mixing instructions along with the data that is provided, the query that is provided, and the models are unable to differentiate between the two. And so very often attackers are able to sneak in specific instructions and able to get things, the models to misbehave. So I think, you know, there is a lot of promising research that we've done in this space on how to sandbox some of these executions, on how to track provenance, and how to build, you know, policies around LLMs and firewalls. Some of these capabilities will have to make their way in. Then we'll have to see what sticks and what doesn't. And as that level of maturity goes up, our confidence in these products is going to go up, and the risk is going to go down.
Absolutely. And that's kind of the way that all this technology moves, right? The new thing comes out and we kind of have to do a little bit of catch up. We experiment with what works, we put it in, and then we get to a place where we can trust these things. Dave, how about you? Anything to add there, what you want to see these browsers do to become safer?
I mean, as the first person to say, no, I wouldn't ever use them. I mean, and the reason is, you know, I mean, they're saying like, well, you should be really careful, Dave. Like human in the loop. Yeah, that's a safeguard, but you know, not the best one, right? So, you know, I like to click on things as much as the next guy, right? But, you know, but in seriousness, you know, you kind of got to go back to fundamentals, right? So visibility, right? And in the world of AI, we like to say things like transparency and observability, but it's fancy words for being able to watch stuff, monitoring, like JR just talked about, right? I want some ability to have protective controls, right? Maybe that's around identity, maybe that's clear permissioning, like things like that inside of browsers. Like, I'm not talking rocket science or high levels of data science. I'm talking about basic security, you know, protective controls, right? And then I want to be able to, like, once identified, I have some ability to respond, right? You know, whatever that may be, right? So, you know, it's just basics, right? And today those basics aren't there, right? And it's just left on my shoulders to be very secure, and that's it's out of my hands today. So, like, that's a silly thing. So, like, you know, I think. You know, for an enterprise to allow these things to happen, right, it's going to require the basics to be there, and like in a like the fundamentals have to be there. Like, how are you watching it? How transparent is it? How auditable is it? When something does happen, what can I do about it? Right? What am I doing to protect those things from potentially happening? Right? I mean, we've built entire industries around doing just those things. So I know that's what I've done. That's what that Suja was wondering. That's what I've done for 20 years. So it's trying to fight those things. So
see, absolutely. The reasoning capacity, the human being is going to reason more, right? As opposed to today's AI, the reasoning capability is not there like a human. Because when you tell it to forget and it forgets, then we have a single cell organism. We're nowhere close to AGI at that point. So we need to be thinking about it because it's a combination of rules as well as reasoning. And the reasoning capability is not there yet.
So yeah, I love that. That's a really optimistic take on this challenge that we're facing, that we're eventually going to get there because we have folks like you working on those security issues. So let's end it on that optimistic note and move on to something actually just as scary, I would say. YouTube's Ghost Network. And yes, I picked this because it has ghost in the title, but it's still interesting. Checkpoint Research has uncovered what it calls the YouTube Ghost Network. This is a series of fake accounts hosting a combined 3,000 videos, all designed to trick people into downloading malware. What's interesting here is that the videos pretend to give people instructions on, you know, downloading cracked software or hacking a game. You know, you turn to it to a tutorial, and of course, if you follow the instructions, what it's actually telling you to do is download and execute some kind of malware on your device, and then you end up compromised. Now, some of the things that are noteworthy here, at least from where I'm looking, is that in addition to these accounts that post videos, the network includes a bunch of fake users who engage with the videos to make them seem more legit. And because there are so many accounts involved, if some get taken down, more can just take its place. So it's a very resilient network. And really interesting to me is that this network has been active since 2021, but its output has sped up in 2025 to triple the pace that it was before this. So I want to start with kind of talking about that tripling of the pace there. What do you think is motivating that? What's allowing them to go so much faster right now? And I will throw to you, Suja. What do you think is speeding things up here?
I think just like everything else, like automation and AI is helping us to create these things much faster. Just like what we saw with phishing, creating an email took 14 days, now it takes minutes. So you are able to go do this with bots much faster than a human would, because I think we have said the humans need to at least go eat, go to the restroom, whatever it is. For AI, they can run 24/7 without sleep doing these things. I think that's what is causing it very, very difficult. And as we stopped reading, looking for instructions, we just now look at a video, 2-minute video to tell me what to do. For everything, we need a hack. So that also makes it very easy and tempting for us to go click on those links.
Yeah, I know I myself am extremely guilty of, I need instructions on something. I just, whatever the first video on YouTube is, I watch it. I don't know who these people are. I shouldn't just be following this blindly. And maybe that makes me ill-qualified to host a cybersecurity show. But anyway, JR, I want to throw to you real quick, because we were just talking before about the kind of evolution of social engineering, right? And you were talking about how social engineering is kind of becoming prompt engineering. Well, here's another new take on social engineering, right? Which is that, like, It's harnessing the trust we have for platforms like YouTube and getting people to do things without even really questioning it. Wondering if you have any thoughts on that aspect of this attack.
Absolutely, Matt. I think what's happening is that the boundaries between what is trusted information and disinformation are blurring and disappearing. And when that happens, what you get is weaponized content that is wrapped in the aesthetics of authenticity. So when the threat and the legitimate experience are indistinguishable, all your traditional defenses are going to fail. And that's exactly what's happening now. Because if you look at some of the specifics of the YouTube ghost networks, users are actually served up content along with instructions as what to do. And exactly as Suja was saying as well, they have provided a recipe, including some really egregious things like temporarily disable your Windows Defender, and they just go off and do that. They sort of meekly follow, and then, of course, they become victims of these kinds of attacks.
Absolutely. Yeah, you're totally right. Like, the disinformation looks exactly the same as the stuff that we've come to trust, right? And there's nothing to kind of warn you, obviously, except your own wits. Dave, want to get you in here. What are your thoughts about this whole ghost network situation?
You've got it expanding, right? Because it's easier to expand. And if it didn't work, There's no reason to automate it. So it's worked, right? And then why does it work? Well, it works because it's trusted, right? And no one's blocking it, right? Because, right? So you've got this trusted source that's being pumped full, right? Like you said, it's accelerating in 2025. So you get this acceleration of bad content cloaked, you know, the wolf in sheep's clothing, if you will, right? JR, thank you for that. That was fantastic, right? Like, so you've got that. So now, like, as a defender, right? Like, you know, how am I going to stop this? Right? It gets to the weakest link, again, is the person clicking, you know, the mouse, right? Or the pad, or, you know, the phone, or whatever it may be, right? So, like, that's where it's got to stop, right? Someone has to have the wherewithal to go, maybe I shouldn't, you know, in this case, you know, we're talking about cracked software or something like that, but it doesn't have to be that. It could be something much more legitimate, you know, to do it. So, like, to me, this is, like, from a defender's perspective, right? Like, this is just another, like, wow, I have to watch, you know, like, I've always had to watch legit sources for, you know, false activity, but now it's just even harder, right? And it's never been a human solvable problem to be a defender. It's always required technology to help us, you know, get a leg up, or at least, you know, like, keep our head above water. And this is just another example of how much more difficult the job of a defender, you know, in today's world has become.
Absolutely. And I think it's a really good point that you bring up that, like, this is something where that person is kind of the first and only line of defense in a lot of ways, right? Because they're being told to just do what the instructions say, and then they end up infecting themselves with malware. So, like, how do you defend against something like that? Like, how do you get in there to stop people from doing this sort of thing? Can you stop them from doing this sort of thing? Sudra, I want to throw it to you to start. What do you think? How do we defend against something like this?
Because literally, like whack-a-mole, because you shut down one, a new thing is going to come up, right? Like, for example, YouTube is something that children start looking at YouTube from, like, the time they're born. This is like having a malware for a previous generation in TV, okay? So this is not something which is an email, you work on it, your text. This is something that you're used to. It's an extremely trusted one. So it's more awareness and education is what I can think of, because you cannot run at the pace at which these are going to come in, to having that understanding that what is legitimate versus not, and not giving into temptation that I'm playing a game now, because most of the time that's what happens. I want to hack and then I go look at it and that's where you get caught. So stay in your lane, man.
That's a really good point that I had not considered, the fact that, like, YouTube also reaches a whole different audience than some of this other stuff, right? Like, you know, I think about, I don't know about you folks, but I've gotten so many of those texts, the scam texts that are like, you have overdue tolls or whatever. And you know, a kid gets that and they're like, I don't drive a car. This is not for me. You know what I mean? But you're right. Who's one of the primary, you know, targets for, like, how do you hack a game? I mean, a lot of kids, they get on and then they can get into some trouble. So that makes me uncomfortable. JR, what are your thoughts on how we go about maybe shoring up our defenses against an attack like this?
I do think that's going to be a mixture of both technical controls that I think platforms like YouTube can put in place. But there is no escaping the fact that one has to have human-in-the-loop education and awareness, exactly as Sujay was saying. So there are things that, for example, YouTube could do. They could bring about a renewed focus around provenance. This is something that we've talked about for a long time, but we have ignored. I think we haven't really architected controls around provenance. So when users come in and upload videos, right, you could assign a provenance to where those videos are, whether they are trustworthy or not. We do this in other places. We can also do this on YouTube. Similarly, when there are instructions, especially those that say, disable your Microsoft Defender, those are things that the platform provider can easily flag so as to ensure something like a zero trust browsing experience. And then they could be, even if you think a little bit further out, we could bring in, along with the sort of the accountability on the platform level, we could bring in some amount of AI moderation as well, things like having AI watermarks or signature verification for uploaded media, right? These are things that we could bring in. So there are, to complement the human awareness aspect, there are technical controls and there are technical steps that platform providers can take.
Absolutely. I like that very much. There are things that can be done. It's not as, you know, insurmountable as it might seem at first glance. Dave, take us home. Anything you would recommend in terms of shoring up our defenses here?
I would like to take Jair's comments. I would like to highlight them. Underline, boldface, and increase the size of the font. No, and seriously, like because like the traditional answer here is, well, you got to educate your users and you got to deploy defense in depth. That's what you got to do, right? And it completely ignores the fact that there's some culpability on the provider side. There are plenty of things to do. And Jared, you just gave tremendous examples of things that the provider can do to check out the link on the other side. And you know what? There's these new technologies that they can use to test these things out. Like, that's like the greatest answer. So that's exactly what we should be doing. Like, it cannot fall to user beware. There has to be culpability on the provider side to check the things out. Yes, you can have a platform that puts links out there, right? But you can also double check that maybe those links are, you know, right? Like, thanks, Chair. That was a great answer.
I totally agree, but given the track record of all the corporations who need to be responsible, I hear you, but that's also a challenge.
Let's move on to our next story here. We've got another concerning new kind of attack. This is Glassworm. Introduces some new tricks to the world of malware. Now, a few weeks ago, we had the shy Hulud worm moving through software supply chains, and this week we have Glassworm. It's been found hidden in 13 compromised extensions on the OpenVSX registry and the Microsoft extension marketplace. Once it gets onto a device, it can drop info stealers and something called Zombie. Again, we got some spooky names here. There's a theme, you know, and something called Zombie, which basically turns the infected device into a proxy for criminal activity. Now, there are two things in particular that I found really, really fascinating about Glassworm. The first was that it uses the Solana blockchain and Google Calendar for command and control activity, right? Which is like, these are two things that I don't know, I don't think they attract a lot of attention as possible sources of maliciousness. And then the other thing it does is it uses invisible Unicode characters called variation selectors to hide the malicious code in the extension's source code. So basically, if you open up the source code, you can't even see the malicious code buried in there because it's hidden with these invisible Unicode characters. So I just want to start with some initial reactions to this. Does this seem as concerning as I think it is? Let me start with you, JR. What are your thoughts about Glassworm?
Oh, I think it is extremely concerning. I think officially we have entered the era of post-infrastructure malware. Let me explain what I mean by post-infrastructure. So previously, you know, you could have a piece of malware that was spreading and it had command and control servers assigned to it. You get the IP addresses. The government helps you. You go in, you seize the equipment to take the command and control out. What is now happening is the malware is using publicly deployed infrastructure, which is ubiquitously available, which is resilient in fault tolerant. So you take down it, you're still available elsewhere. And that's the case with Solana, right? Because, you know, it's public, it's immutable, and it's ubiquitous. And you just can't take that down, right? I mean, so it's not as easy as taking down a command and control server. And the same thing, you know, what you saw in this particular case is that this was very similar to, you know, they had actually built layers of resilience, because the first layer of resilience was using Solana. The second layer was using Google Calendar. Now, cloud APIs like Calendar and Drive are always allowed through enterprise firewalls. And Google Calendar is something that has been architected so that it's available all the time, right? So malware is now beginning to take advantage of this. And now when you add that icing, that you can now have invisible characters, we always knew Unicode cloaking was a problem. Experts are not going to be able to see the difference. If you do any differences in GitHub, it won't show you these characters. And what's happening is, you know, the code looks benign visually, but functionally it is altered because of Unicode characters. So this combination is really advance on the be on the part of the attackers, which is something we cannot ignore.
Post-infrastructure malware, I really, really like that. And again, I feel awful learning about that right here for the first time. Dave, what are your thoughts on this situation, this world of post-infrastructure malware and Glassworm?
Yeah, I love that phrase as well. That's why JR is who he is. He should name everything for us. I think isn't the creativity, and ingenuity here, like astounding? Like, it's just crazy. I mean, hiding characters, okay, maybe not that part of it, but the blockchain part of it, right? And very well explained, JR. Right? I think that's the bit that's it. This is what the detect and respond mechanism playbook is completely gone. I can't detect it and I can't respond to it. I've got nothing, right? So I have to wait until the attack has happened. There's no real responding to root cause, right? So, you know, it's shoring up defenses, and defense becomes, the playbook in other areas responds, but when I go straight into threat management around, identify the, investigate, right? Like that core cycle, it's completely done. There's nothing I can do, right? I cannot get to those core servers, because if I manage to find one, it's gone, right? So nobody's happy smiley facing or thumbs upping it, but every now and again something comes along and you're like, oh, that's clever.
This was supposed to be our spooky episode, and I think we're making it even spookier than I thought it was going to be. Suja, how are you feeling about this? I mean, the detect and response playbook being kind of completely disrupted here. What are your thoughts on this situation?
I'm good. I think JR said it better, so I don't have any comment.
Fair enough. So then let's move on to kind of, Dave, you were saying, look, it's what we do is we adapt to this sort of thing, right? We see every once in a while, you see something, you say, hey, that's really clever, but we don't have time to rest on our laurels. We got to do something about it. So how do we adapt to something like this? And I'll swing back to you again, JR. Do you have thoughts on what is required of us in this moment?
Fundamentally, the idea under post-infrastructure malware is that malware is relying upon publicly available infrastructure to execute its purposes, which means that if we have publicly deployed infrastructure, they have to up the game in terms of protecting against use, abuse, and misuse by such malware. And what that means is, if you take something like the Solana blockchain, I think we are going to see the emergence of an era where you'll have telemetry and threat detection and intelligence around blockchains. That may be a subfield that's going to come. Similarly, if you look at something like Google API, Google Calendar, we might actually have something like context-aware cloud API inspection. We've had things around cloud security before, but these kinds of developments may bring that back into fashion. And then finally, if you look at things like Unicode cloaking, I think we'll have to do something around Unicode normalization and auditing of differences. Maybe things like software bills of materials and linters, which are more Unicode aware, may become more important as we go forward. But definitely, it's not going to be a one-trick solution. It will require a village to get this thing done.
According to Verizon, organizations are neglecting mobile security. Now, Verizon Business's 2025 Mobile Security Index came out recently, and it reports that people are far more likely to fall for smishing attacks, or SMS phishing, than for email phishing. And attackers know this, hence the increase in smishing attacks recently. But we're not seeing corresponding increases in investment in mobile security tools, which these organizations wide open. So my first question here is why do you think organizations are kind of neglecting to invest in mobile security? And I'm going to throw it to you first, Suja. Any thoughts on why this is a gap for so many companies right now?
Well, look, if most companies, when they give out mobile devices, it does come with security, right? Whether it is Edge or whatever. Like, for example, in our own organization, we use like IBM's Mastery 16, everyone, so that you know what is going on. Even if you accidentally click the link, we are able to intercept and then say, okay, this is not something you're supposed to click. As Dave pointed out, our job is to click on things. So it's very difficult to tell people and say, don't click on things. And you're preoccupied and you might accidentally click something. But in today's world, if you think about it, in many, many companies, people are bringing their own device to work. When they are bringing their own device, does it have the same level of security in it? That's something we fail to look at. And in today's world, that opens it up. And you're taking your work device everywhere else, and then the home device comes to your work network. It's a huge challenge with like device proliferation.
Absolutely. And Dave, anything to add there? What are your thoughts on why this is such a gap for so many organizations?
I was busy trying to pay a toll that I just got a text about. It was worth a shot. No, make myself laugh. I think Suja, you hit it right. I mean, it's if it was just the, you know, like a laptop, right? Like the company issues a laptop and they can lock it down, and you know, your primary use is work. Sure, you might do some things here or there. This is a mobile phone or a mobile smartphone or whatever we're calling these, you know, computers these days that we carry around in our pockets, right? Like, you know, it's bring your own device. It's shared use. It's, you know, you throw it to the kid in the back seat so they'd be quiet, right? Like, you know, like there's a zillion things that happen to that device, right? And so, you know, you can't lock it down like the corporate, like some companies can, right? I think we do a pretty darn good job about it. But I think it's, there's outrage. Like, what do you mean I can't do this? I can't do that, right? And even when you do that, there's still quite a bit of, you know, of things, of bad things that you could potentially do. But I also think there's this mindset that, you know, it's not attached to anything. Right. I don't touch the data. Like, I don't really look at, I don't log into, right. You know, now increasingly there are, but even then, like, oh, well, it's just the app. That app, you know, I might log into my, you know, my SAP app or my, you know, whatever app, but that's not the real thing. Yeah, it is. Right. You know what I mean? Right. Like, you know, I think there's a mindset in the larger, you know, population that, like, you know, it's just my phone. My phone isn't my laptop. It's not what it really is, which is an extension of the enterprise. That's the edge of the network. It's right there in your hand, right? And as you access it and things like that. So I think that's the second part of it, is that, you know, they are ubiquitous. They're all over the place. They're used in very different ways than other, you know, resources within the enterprise. You know, and then you know, there's like, they don't think about them in the same way as they would a laptop, right? I don't know. I think that's the challenge. I do think that it is something that's easily overcome, right? Because you just need to say it, right? Like, no, that's our phone, right? That's our, right. This is the acceptable use. This is what we're going to go do with it, right? And thou shall not do these things there, right? And sure, you can do, you know, this is what, you know, personal use on your work device is allowed and not allowed, you know, and, you know, whether that includes social or not include social or includes, you know, kid games or whatever, like that's, you know, within the safety, but you must run these apps, whatever it may be. So I think that's a very enforceable thing. I just think that's the next step.
Something I'm thinking about, especially after, you know, Dave, you're talking about how part of the answer here is you just say, no, that's our phone. But what about the opportunity for shadow IT? I mean, there's a lot of people who, even if you tell them, don't touch this data with your personal phone, they might go ahead and touch that data with their personal phone. I'm wondering if we have anything to kind of combat that angle. And I want to ask you about that, JR. Do you think shadow IT is a problem here in this world of mobile security?
Oh, absolutely. I think very much like what Dave was saying, what we are confronted with is not just a technical problem, but a cultural problem, right? It's both technical and cultural. Technical on the side that, you know, actually when mobile phones first came out, when we looked at some of their architectures, at first, they held the promise of being more secure than what our desktops, what our laptops, what our MacBooks were like. But over a period of time, from a technical perspective, the enterprise security governance mechanisms like endpoint detection and response, things like this that we've applied to mobile, to corporate endpoints, they've become so strong. And on the other side, the culture has also reinforced that a certain kinds of behavior around corporate endpoints. But when you come to mobile endpoints, very often these are bring your own devices. The corporate governance has lagged behind because many people are hesitant to put, they will use their mobile endpoints, their phones to take calls or to call in, but they're kind of hesitant. They still draw a line on their mobile device between personal use and official use. And furthermore, the corporate governance has lagged behind. We don't have EDR solutions deployed on these endpoints. And culturally, because we start using it for a host of personal applications, whether it's social media, it's professional media, we don't hesitate as much to go click on a link and open it on a mobile endpoint that we would have done on a corporate endpoint. So it's both technical and cultural in that sense, and it's almost a perfect storm again. And absolutely, there are things that, again, we have to raise the bar, especially if these mobile endpoints are going to be used for corporate functions, as to what, both from a technical perspective, like EDR solutions, and also a user awareness perspective, what is acceptable or unacceptable use of these devices.
I think what people don't understand is a lot of people talk about privacy, especially technologists. They would say, I will not put these corporate spyware in my phone. What they don't realize is with that, they probably would have been much more secure than what they had. If they just gave the data to one corporation, they prevented it from going for so many other bad things. I think we don't think like that when we are really working, because I would rather have that corporate security in my phone rather than my personal phone, which doesn't have any security.
And that kind of gets to, you know, what I think is a really important through line of this entire episode, maybe every single episode we've ever done, which is that, like, human psychology plays such a role in a lot of these security challenges. Because like you said, Suja, for a lot of people, they hear, wait a minute, you want to put software on my phone? That's an invasion of my privacy. And I get that, but it's also like, okay, but would you rather have your privacy invaded that way? Or would you like it invaded by a bunch of hackers on the dark web who sell your data? You know what I mean? Like, there are trade-offs that have to be made. Moving along, because we're almost out of time, I've got one last topic for you folks here, and I think we're going to treat it like a quick roundtable. Security repercussions of the AWS outage. Now, last week's outage, as I'm sure you're all aware, wasn't caused by a cyber attack, but it did expose just how fragile some of our core internet infrastructure can be, right? One sort of area of AWS went down, and that affected Amazon's website, Ring Cameras, Signal, Riverside, the app we used to record this podcast was down that day. So much stuff just broke because one little thing shut down. And I'm wondering, you know, from your perspective as security professionals, what kind of lessons do you think this holds for us in terms of how we build a more resilient infrastructure overall? And I'll go around real quick. Suja, let's start with you. What are your thoughts here?
But whenever there is automation, the resiliency goes out the door, right? Like, because that is something we learn. It's extremely important to keep resiliency. Just like how security is top of mind for us, with agents, with AI proliferation and automation, resiliency becomes really, really, really key. Because you're talking about it, I was reading about how mattresses got hot and they couldn't bring it down because these were all done using an app. And then because of this outage, and I was like, really? Mattresses? Because today, that's the level of automation we have. Everything operates using cloud. Right? So resiliency becomes extremely key. Just like the garage door has a hatch, like which you can open when the electricity goes off, what is that that's going to get you out? So that's very, very important when we are designing these systems.
Absolutely. And, you know, I laugh, but like, yeah, I'd be pretty mad if my bed was too hot and I couldn't shut it off because of AWS was down. Dave, how about you? What are your thoughts on the kind of resiliency angle here?
I'm not sure I can follow a hot mattress, I mean, it's tough. It's tough. Look, I think it's about contingency planning. Oh my gosh, it's AWS. They've taken care of that for me. Maybe, right? The good news here is that the tech exists, right? You can pop between providers easier than ever before. That barrier to move, you know, has never been lower in the history of tech, right? I mean, you don't have to pick up and have a whole different data center. You don't have to roll, like, you can just move the workload, right? So, like, this didn't have to be as someone should have been able to cool off their mattress, right? Like, you didn't have, right? Like, that's a great story. I missed that part of it, to be honest with you. I heard about some of the other ones. But, you know, like the, you know, like that's contingency planning, right? That's saying like, hey, this is something. What is my contingency plan if this happened? Even if it's a one in a whatever shot, right? Like, what is it? Okay, it's this. All right, cool. If that happens, I push this button and I'm back up in whatever time, right? Like, that's not magical, right? Like, that's, again, that's just kind of common sense kind of a thing. Like, my clients require me to be here 100%. And so whoever I'm building this on, whether I do it myself or I rely on a big provider who almost never goes down, but what if they did? I mean, so that's just, again, it's resiliency, just like Suja said. So, you know, it's just kind of poor planning and not really understanding that the barrier to move and move workloads around, like, it's not high. The tech exists. Just needed to be done.
JR, how about you to close us out today? What are your thoughts on this AWS situation and what it teaches us about resilient systems?
So I think one of the biggest lessons that security has taught us in the last, I would say, ever since the Google Aurora attacks of 2008 is how incredibly interconnected and dependent we are on each other. And when we lose sight of that, how we are going to pay the price. So if you look at the AWS outage, despite having multiple zones, this availability zones and fault tolerance built in, things like key aspects of the AWS infrastructure, like identity and access management, and some of their CI/CD pipelines, were still being served out of the US East geography. And what happened as a consequence of that was everybody else, including all the businesses that you mentioned, mattresses business included, were all dependent upon US East. So if you lose sight of dependency, right, in this incredibly interconnected world, then there is a price we're going to pay. And that's the place we would start in trying to rebuild resiliency for our infrastructure like clouds as we go forward.
Absolutely. You can't lose sight of those dependencies. JR, I feel like I should have you on every single episode because you have a gift for summarizing all of these topics and making them so clear and crisp and to the point. But that is all the time we have for today, folks. Thank you to our panelists, Suja and JR and Dave. Thank you to the viewers. Thank you to Brian Clark for stepping in for me on short notice last week. As always, subscribe to Security Intelligence wherever podcasts are found. Stay safe out there and watch out for things that go bump on the web. Up next, a sneak peek of a very special episode. Check out the Security Intelligence podcast on Spotify, Apple, or wherever you get your podcasts this Friday for the full audio experience to hear the terrifying tale of just how easy it is to break into your corporate office. You're the receptionist at a mid-sized firm in Los Angeles, and a woman you've never met before walks right up to you. She's interviewing with the company next door, and she just spilled coffee all over her resume. She's got extra copies right here on a flash drive. If you could print her off a new copy, that would be amazing. But then you'd be falling right into the trap laid for you by Stephanie Carruthers. Stephanie is an expert in social engineering, particularly the kind that involves breaking into people's buildings.
Physical assessments are by far my favorite, and I think a lot of social engineers' favorite, because it's the most tangible thing you can do.